From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in the winter of 2004 and 2005 in Ukraine, where the so-called Orange Revolution was unfolding. Ukrainian Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych was trying to hold on to power, and despite massive public demonstrations and organizing, Yanukovych was declared the winner in the national election. But international inspectors had said the election was marred by massive fraud, and eventually a court overturned the result in favor of Viktor Yushchenko, known as being friendlier with the West. Now, Yanukovych was furious with his Russian advisors, according to the New York Times. He wanted someone with a better track record of success, someone who could rework his image and help him regain the power he had lost. So he hired a man named Paul Manafort. With Manafort's guidance, Yanukovych enjoyed a comeback, with his party winning the biggest bloc in 2006. By 2007, he was back in the prime minister's seat. This despite his history, which included not only claims of corruption, but two convictions of assault when he was younger. Yanukovych always had the record of a classic thug, but Manafort insisted he was simply misunderstood by those of us in the West. In 2010, Yanukovych won the presidency of Ukraine. The Times reports that Manafort had created an approach that, quote, exploited regional and ethnic peculiarities in voting, tapping the disenfranchisement of those who felt abandoned by the Orange Revolution in eastern Ukraine, end quote. Does that sound familiar? You might know that Yanukovych was closely tied to Vladimir Putin in Russia, that Yanukovych accumulated more wealth and palaces while the population struggled, and that eventually Yanukovych fled the country after being removed from power in 2014. Where did he go? Well, reports immediately surfaced of a secret deal to keep him safe in Russia. All of which brings us back to Paul Manafort and Donald Trump. Paul Manafort, the architect of Yanukovych's revival, is now the campaign manager for Donald Trump. The Times reports that it's not even clear if Manafort is still being paid to work in Ukrainian affairs, and Trump has made numerous statements in recent weeks that would indicate he would govern in a way that would be greatly beneficial to Vladimir Putin and Russia. This hour, we welcome a guest who can help us sort out what are the legitimate questions about all this and what is the noise regarding Trump, Putin, and Russia. My guest is Dr. Randy Stone, director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Randy, welcome back.
Hi, Evan. Good to be back.
Well, I would also just clarify for the audience here, Randy is someone who I sort of email like from time to time just to check in with questions, sometimes not even for show booking purposes. He's always helpful regarding understanding what is going on. And we've talked about Russia, Ukraine, and other interests. I don't at all view Dr. Stone as overtly political. In fact, on this program, you've at times been praising of President Obama and critical. So I just sort of laying the groundwork to say this is not attempted to be an overtly political hour. I think what we want to do is ask, what do the experts think are the legitimate questions here? So let me just start broadly. You've done a lot of reading. There's been a lot of questions. What's the biggest question in your mind right now?
Well, the biggest question, frankly, is whether this is a novel written by Tom Clancy or whether this is an episode of House of Cards. I've been mystified as I see one revelation after another come out about this this whole affair. It reads like a conspiracy theory. You know, when I was in Moscow in 1991-92, the parlor game that we all played was who can come up with a conspiracy theory to explain what's happening that's a little more complicated, has one more twist than the other guy. And, you know, the one with the most twists always won. And so this it has a little bit of that flavor. This kind of started a week ago with a conversation about the hacking issue and whether, you know, does it make sense that, you know, that this hacking could be Russia trying to intervene in a U.S. political election. And then over the course of the last week, we've had more and more and more interesting things revealed.
Well, we're going to kind of try to work through one by one. And listeners, if you've got questions, you can join the program this hour as well. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Trump was on with George Stephanopoulos on ABC News yesterday, and he seemed kind of annoyed to be asked about his relationship with Putin. But Trump himself, for years, has been saying positive things about Putin and the fact that they have this relationship. And if you want the evidence, let's listen to several cases. First, 2013, this is Trump with Thomas Roberts on MSNBC.
Do you have a relationship with Vladimir Putin, a conversational relationship, or anything that you feel you have sway or influence over his government?
I do have a relationship, and I can tell you that he's very interested in what we're doing here today. He's probably very interested in what you and I are saying today, and I'm sure he's going to be seeing it in some form. But I do have a relationship with him.
Okay, this is next one, 2014, speaking at the National Press Club luncheon in May of 2014.
Well, I own the Miss Universe. I was in Russia. I was in Moscow recently, and I spoke indirectly and directly with President Putin, who could not have been nicer.
Indirectly and directly. That means you talk to them, okay? And this is 2015 at one of the many debates. This is what people have been referring to as the 60-minute stable comment, Donald Trump at a debate last year.
And I got to know him very well because we were both on 60 Minutes. We were stablemates, and we did very well that night.
All of this brings us to yesterday, Donald Trump talking to George Stephanopoulos about this relationship that he's been touting for years.
What exactly is your relationship with Vladimir Putin?
I have no relationship with Putin. I have no relationship with Putin.
But if you have no relationship with Putin, then why did you say in 2013, I do have a relationship? In 2014, I spoke.
Because he has said nice things about me over the years. I remember years ago, he said something, many years ago, he said something very nice about me. I said something good about him when Larry King was on. This was a long time ago. And I said, he is a tough cookie, or something to that effect. He said something nice about me. This has been going on. We did 60 Minutes together. By the way, not together together, meaning he was probably shot in Moscow.
Well, he was in Moscow, you were in New York. But that's the thing.
No, just so you understand, he said very nice things about me, but I have no relationship with him. I don't.
Yet you said for 3 years, 13, 14, and 15, that you did have a relationship with him.
No, look, what do you call a relationship? I mean, he treats me with great respect. I have no relationship with Putin.
Trump went on to say he couldn't even remember even having a single phone call and has maybe never talked to Putin, would only know what he looks like. I mean, this doesn't require a whole lot of analysis other than to say it's totally incoherent, isn't it, Randy?
Well, yes. There are a lot of things that Donald Trump has said that are inconsistent with other things that Donald Trump has said. And it's remarkable that the electorate doesn't seem to have yet caught up with this fact. But I think sooner or later, this is bound to catch up with him.
All right. So as we start to work in some of the other issues related, how much should we care which version of this story is true? In other words, Trump saying for years he has had a friendly relationship with Putin. Now him saying, I wouldn't know him from Adam other than I know what he looks like. Should we care about if he's had this relationship at all?
Well, I guess what worries me about this whole story is, what does all this mean for U.S. foreign policy going forward? And there are two scenarios. There's the, I think, fairly unlikely scenario where Donald Trump wins. And then there's the much more likely scenario where Donald Trump does not win, but there is still some collateral damage from this whole discussion that affects Hillary Clinton's foreign policy going forward. We know that Donald Trump has staked out some positions on Russia, which are frankly unique in the political spectrum in this country. We have a very strong bipartisan consensus that Russia has been a very bad actor for the last few years, since about 2011, when there were protests in Moscow over the rigged parliamentary elections in December, which then went on for weeks and weeks and became very embarrassing to Putin. From that point, Putin has been distancing himself from the West and has been taking offense at American efforts to promote democracy in his part of the world. And on both sides of the aisle, Democrats and Republicans have been very strong in supporting the Obama administration's policy of imposing sanctions to punish Russia for invading and then annexing Crimea, which was a part of Ukraine, a separate, independent, sovereign country at the time for 25 years, and for trying to contain Russia, which in recent years has shown a great deal of aggressive tendency towards some of its neighbors. And Donald Trump has been throwing that consensus overboard, saying that, well, perhaps we won't defend NATO allies if they're attacked. It depends on whether they've done enough to contribute to our alliance. Sometimes he suggests even to our coffers. If they haven't paid their dues, then we might not defend them. And we also know that his advisors, as you started the show discussing, Paul Manafort, who is his campaign advisor, The campaign advisor usually goes on to be the chief of staff in the new administration, which is the second most powerful person in the administration, someone who doesn't have to be confirmed by the Senate, but who throws around a lot of weight on foreign policy and domestic policy. Paul Manafort was deeply involved in Ukrainian politics as a political operative, and always on the wrong side from the perspective of either a Democratic or a Republican administration.
Well, he said, we just misunderstood Yanukovych. You know, he was misunderstood by the West.
Yeah, poor guy. He was so misunderstood. I mean, he stole one election, or tried to, and then he, by some incredible sleight of hand, managed to be reelected. So he was elected in a Democratic election that was held by his successors, and then he immediately started reversing democracy once again. One of the first things he did once he came to office was to jail Yulia Tymoshenko, who was his main political opponent. She was a former prime minister of Ukraine.
This was in 2010. Grounds of corruption? What were the grounds of
it? It was supposedly abuse of power.
Abuse of power.
The point here is not that Yulia Tymoshenko was squeaky clean. I don't think anybody in Ukrainian politics is squeaky clean, but that these particular charges were just all trumped up, and they were done. It was done for political reasons, and so there was an outcry around the world. All of our European allies in the United States protested this. We very much tried to get Yanukovych to back down. And interestingly enough, the New York Times article yesterday indicates that no one other than Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign advisor now, wrote the legal brief justifying her imprisonment. Yulia Tymoshenko withered away in prison. She was on a hunger strike for a long time. Her health became seriously impaired. She was eventually released when enough of the European Union countries threatened to break relations with Ukraine over this issue. He was very deeply involved in Ukrainian politics and was the political operative who was trying to get the former dictator reelected. His strategy is interesting. He urged Yanukovych to eschew any programmatic statements, not to tell people specifically what he was going to do, simply to take the standard of the opposition, to point out that the economy is terrible in Ukraine. And of course, the economy has always been terrible in Ukraine. So there's always a basis to attack the current government on that basis. And then to divide people along ethnic national lines. So Ukraine has always had a fissure line that runs through it. A large portion of the population speaks Ukrainian as a native language. A large portion of the population speaks Russian as a native language. And then there are a lot of bilingual people. And the people in the East primarily are Russian speakers. And so focus on those folks and focus on the people who are dissatisfied with the current government because the economy is bad. It was what I'd call a national populist message. And it's remarkable how similar that message is to Donald Trump's message in this election.
I mean, I don't mean to be flippant, but it is not a far cry. I would not be surprised if one of the main campaign themes was make Ukraine great again. I mean, there are so many similarities there that we see showing up. But the New York Times in their piece even pointed out, this is something that I did not know about Manafort. Quoting from the New York Times yesterday, quote, Manafort began his career in Republican politics in the 1970s and extended it overseas to advising authoritarian leaders, including in Zaire, Ferdinand Marcos in the Philippines, and Mr. Yanukovych in Ukraine. Ferdinand Marcos. And we look at these histories. Is someone going to sit down with Paul Manafort? And I guess maybe someone has asked them about this or asked Donald Trump, is this the guy you want advising you? But I guess, I don't know. I mean, should we be concerned about that?
I don't know how it is that Paul Manafort got to be campaign manager. I guess Trump was looking around for a new campaign manager after the former one, Lewandowski, got into a brawl with a protester. But evidently, they don't have a very deep organization. They don't do a good job of vetting things, as we saw with the plagiarism scandal
at the convention. Yeah.
It just seems like they don't have much of an organization. So it's plausible to think that they're just all disorganized and don't know what they're doing, and they end up with these people in important positions. But what's worrisome about it is that he's in a position to exert a lot of influence if Trump became president.
All right. And so then when it comes to that influence, the question becomes, well, if Trump were either influenced by Manafort or following his own instincts that are sort of friendly with Putin or whatever the case may be, what would those policies or decisions look like? And in recent days, we've started to see a number of things that we can assume Trump may want to do based on his own comments. Randy, you mentioned the fact that he has said he doesn't know if he would defend NATO allies based on whether they've paid their bills. He doesn't want to keep giving allies a free ride. So if Estonia doesn't pay up, maybe we don't show up to help even though we've promised because we didn't get our money. And George Stephanopoulos asked him about that among a number of things, and let's go ahead and listen. As Trump on NATO, let's listen to what he said yesterday, Rob.
If our country got along with Russia, that would be a great thing. When Putin goes out and tells everybody, and you talk about relationship, but he says Donald Trump is going to win and Donald Trump is a genius. And then I have people saying you should disavow. I said, I'm going to disavow that. But when Putin says good things and when we have a possibility of having a good relationship with Russia, I think that's good.
But if we have a good relationship by bowing to his annexation,
we're not going to be bowing to anybody. Hey, George, you know me pretty well. I don't bow, okay? I don't bow. But if we can have a good relationship with Russia, and if Russia would help us get rid of ISIS, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, you're talking about tremendous amounts of money and lives and everything else, that would be a positive thing, not a negative.
Even if that means conditioning our commitments to NATO, as you said?
No, because you're not going to do that. NATO is going to be just fine, but NATO countries, we have 28 countries, many of them are taking advantage of us because they're not paying. So we're protecting these countries and they're not paying. And when people leave that last part in, everybody agrees with me.
Okay, there's Trump on NATO. Randy, what are the implications if the American president, whoever it is, decides we may not honor the commitment based on whether our NATO allies have paid bills?
This is an interesting point because I'm not sure whether Donald Trump understands how NATO works. I mean, NATO is not a golf club where you pay your dues in order to be a member, and if you don't pay your dues, you're thrown out.
Yeah, like you're on the fourth green and they say, sir, you haven't paid your monthly dues, you can't play anymore.
Right. I mean, there are no dues. So there's nothing that Estonia is required to pay to the United States as a part of being part of NATO. NATO was a voluntary alliance that was established finally in 1955. In 1955, it incorporated Germany. It was established 6 years earlier. But it was a NATO was a voluntary alliance that was since then has incorporated all of our major allies in Europe and has gradually expanded after the end of the Cold War. But it was a one-way guarantee. It was as it was initially constructed. The assumption was our allies were in no position to pay. They were in no position to defend themselves. They were wrecked after World War II. The United States had the military, had the largest economy in the world, and it was in our interest to make sure that the Soviet Union did not take over all those territories. And so we gave a unilateral guarantee, but to make it seem a little bit more palatable, we made it multilateral. That they also guaranteed our security. Now, at the time, we knew, that would never be invoked. I mean, the United States didn't need any defense from any of these countries. Strangely enough, the only time that Article 5 of NATO, which is the article that requires member states to come to each other's defense, the only time that it's actually been invoked was after 9/11. And it was the United States that invoked it, and all of our allies joined us. And they all participated in the subsequent campaign in Afghanistan. Right,
to the extent that they could, right?
They all sent some forces. They all sent contributions. They all sent logistical support. So the campaign then to remove the Taliban government in Afghanistan, and then subsequently to attempt to rebuild the the country. That's just an irony there. But there are some expectations about burden sharing in NATO. They're kind of informal. There are agreements that member states will contribute to their own defense, and that by doing that, they make a contribution to NATO, as that they will spend a certain percentage of their GDP, their economies, on defense. And sometimes the United States complains that one country or another has cut their defense spending below a level that we think is appropriate. And we negotiate about it, and we get an agreement, and they increase their defense spending a little bit or something. But they're not paying dues. Now, the only countries that actually pay the United States are countries where the United States has troops stationed. And so Germany and Japan pay substantial amounts of money, which defray the cost of the United States stationing troops in those countries. Of course, Japan is not a NATO member. But that's outside of the framework of NATO. Those are based on bilateral agreements. So Estonia doesn't owe anything on their bills. There's nothing that we can hold over them and say, well, you know, you haven't maintained your side of the bargain. But we have a solemn commitment to Estonia because we admitted them to NATO. NATO expanded twice after the end of the Cold War. The first expansion included countries like Poland and Hungary, the Czech Republic. And those countries joined NATO in the mid-1990s, under when President Bill Clinton was in office. And then there was another expansion of NATO in 1999, and the additional that brought in countries like Bulgaria and Romania, and the three former Soviet republics of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Now, at the time, there were many experts. I was one of them who thought that including Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania might be too provocative, that those were part of the former Soviet Union. We were now extending a military guarantee to those countries, and it was not be out of the realm of possibility that that might involve us in a war at some point with
Russia.
Pulled
into a war with Russia, right, okay.
Right. And there was a debate under the George W. Bush administration about expanding NATO membership to Ukraine and Georgia, which would have pushed our commitment to go to war all the way, a few hundred miles from Moscow. That seemed like a very unwise thing to me at the time, because Ukraine and Georgia are both very unstable countries. They had very shaky records in terms of maintaining democracy. They went back and forth between democracy and dictatorship, both countries, several times. those didn't seem like reliable allies, and they seemed like countries that were very likely to get involved in conflict with Russia, and both of them have subsequently gotten involved in conflict with Russia. But we have made a commitment to Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. It's a solemn commitment. If they are attacked by Russia, and the United States does not go to war with Russia, then NATO becomes a dead letter. Then the basis of America's foreign policy since the end of World War II is overturned. And Europe has been key as to everything that the United States tries to accomplish in the world, not just in terms of international security, but also in terms of international economic cooperation and so forth. Undermining that basic tenet of American foreign policy is very, very harmful. Now, I don't think it's likely that even a President Trump would actually do that. Right? Once he got into office, somebody would sit down with him and say, okay, you said some crazy things during the campaign, but we can't go forward like that, or the consequences are just unbelievable. However, there's a lot of damage that's done just by raising these questions. I'm involved in conversations in Moscow twice a year with groups of experts who meet and talk about U.S.-Russian relations. And I've been struck by the frequency with which elite Russians who speak English very fluently, their English is better than my Russian, they get most of their news from English language sources. You know, they are not limited to the Kremlin view of the world. They question whether the United States is really committed to defending Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania
and
under
Article
5. And to
be clear, 5. Not because of Donald Trump. We're talking pre-Trump. There have been questions about commitment to NATO.
That's right. I heard this most recently back in December in Moscow. And I heard it the previous May in Moscow. This question is already in the air as far as they're concerned. They think they might be able to get away with reabsorbing those countries. And the United States wouldn't really back down, would not resist it. And I think that is, now to be clear, they're not arguing that this is something that Russia should do. We're talking hypothetically.
Sure.
But that's very frightening. If elites in Moscow think that that's the case before Donald Trump, the whole discussion that Donald Trump raises has got to increase the uncertainty.
It must amplify this notion that maybe our country, whoever the president is, wouldn't be committed. And do you see Putin as the kind of actor who may feel like he was able to take the low-hanging fruit in Crimea, very little consequence, and is it time to do it? Do you foresee that as a possibility?
I think it is a possibility, not immediately. I mean, I think right now he has more than he wants to deal with in Ukraine. I mean, he's finding that absorbing Crimea was a little more expensive than he intended to do. He's already gone back on some of his promises to Crimeans. And he's found that, he's effectively occupied two provinces of Ukraine in the east, the Donetsk province and the Luhansk province, with ununiformed proxy Russian soldiers who are posing as Ukrainian revolutionaries. And that's expensive and costly and so forth. He probably is not looking to further overextend himself at the moment. But one could very easily imagine circumstances in which the situation deteriorates in Ukraine. Putin is looking for some place to escalate out of theater and chooses to put pressure on the NATO alliance by using the same strategy that he used in Ukraine, sending ununiformed Russian army officers and enlisted people into Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. Those are already countries that have substantial Russian populations. It would be plausible that maybe this is the local people who are rising up and sort of create pressure that way. It's hard to imagine that any American administration would not respond to that by sending troops, by sort of bolstering the presence, closing the border, that this might then escalate through various accidents and so forth. And then you're talking about a very dangerous situation.
We're talking to Randy Stone, my guest for the hour, and Dr. Stone's the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. How interesting. One of the first comments via email was someone saying, Evan, absolutely riveting. Too bad I've got to get into a work meeting, but we'll listen to the rest later. But Sandy, a different listener, writes me an email that says, so Evan is hopping on the demonized Russia and Putin train, turning it off now. I don't even know what that means, Sandy. I don't. I mean, I'm not demonizing Russia or Putin. I'm trying to analyze. Look, Randy thinks it's unlikely that Trump is the next president, but it's possible. I actually think it's more likely than not at this point, but I've been wrong about him at every step. But the bottom line is it is a possibility. Part of my job is to help us understand what's going on in the world and how our policies may impact them, and that's why we invited Randy Stone to help us do that. We've got your questions on tax returns and other things. So we're going to take our only break of the hour. We're going to come back, get to some of your questions that have come in via email. And if you want to call the program, you can call toll-free 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, it's our monthly science roundtable. We're looking at climate change, and we're looking at the kind of technology that could help mitigate the impact of burning fossil fuels. We're talking about carbon capture. It's not carbon sequestration. We'll talk about what carbon capture is, how it works, and whether it is a realistic way to help fight climate change. That's next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A question from a listener about what happened at the Republican National Convention regarding the party's platform. A listener was asking simply, essentially, what happened there. They had heard some reporting that the platform was moved to be pro-Russia. Best I can tell, well, let me go ahead and listen to what Trump and George Stephanopoulos said yesterday on ABC News. This came up, but before that, just sort of a setup. The party platform, which always comes up before the conventions, my understanding is the Republican Party platform didn't get a whole lot of input from the Trump people, with one exception, that the notion of arming Ukraine to help them deal with, Randy, how do you understand it? Let me just ask you that, and then we'll listen.
Well, there's an ongoing civil war in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Two important industrial provinces in the eastern part of Ukraine are essentially occupied by Russian troops who are out of uniform, who are sort of posing as local forces, and some local forces who are supporting them. And there's been an on and off ceasefire. Every so often it gets broken and there's a lot of fighting, and then it is reestablished and broken and reestablished. And Putin seems to use that to exert pressure over bargaining on Ukraine. And there's been a mounting movement to increase the amount of aid that the United States is giving. So far, the United States has supposedly been giving only non-lethal aid to Ukraine so as not to escalate the conflict further. But there are U.S. special forces involved in Ukraine. There are a lot of advisors and so forth. The question is, should it be escalated to military aid? Should we send military equipment? The proposal that was made at the convention platform committee was that that should be part of the Republican platform. And that was the proposal that was taken out.
The Trump people intervened specifically to make sure that was changed.
That's right. That was as far as the reporters have been able to tell, that was the only point on which the Trump campaign intervened in the
They didn't want to talk about abortion. They didn't want to talk about tax policy. They didn't want to talk about other domestic policy, but they did want to talk about Ukraine. And again, if you missed it earlier, Paul Manafort, the guy who's been helping run Trump's campaign, helped lead the campaign of Viktor Yanukovych, a former Ukrainian leader now and is exile. Is that the right word, Randy? I mean, where?
That's right. He's in exile in Moscow, and he is not welcome in Ukraine.
So Paul Manafort's got these ties to, as Randy said, the wrong side of the authoritarian regimes in Ukraine in history. So let's listen to George Stephanopoulos and Donald Trump yesterday on ABC News.
Why did you soften the GOP platform on Ukraine?
I wasn't involved in that. Honestly,
your
I was not
were.
Involved. Yeah, I was not involved in that. I'd like to, I'd have to take a look at it, but I was not involved.
Do you know what they did?
They softened it, I heard, but I was not involved.
They took away the part of the platform calling for provision of lethal weapons to Ukraine to defend themselves. Why is that a good idea?
I have my own ideas. He's not going into Ukraine, okay? Just so you understand. He's not going to go into Ukraine. All right, you can mark it down, you can put it down, you can take it anywhere
you want.
Well,
he's already there, isn't he?
Okay. Well, he's there in a certain way, but I'm not there. You have Obama there. And frankly, that whole part of the world is a mess under Obama. With all the strength that you're talking about and all of the power of NATO and all of this, in the meantime, he's going away. He takes Crimea. He's sort of,
But you said you might recognize that.
I'm going to take a look at it. But, you know, the people of Crimea, from what I've heard, would rather be with Russia than where they were. And you have to look at that also.
A lot there to chew on. Let me just start with the beginning. Trump claiming he sort of didn't really know much about his own people changing the platform, which is either an obfuscation or an indication of a leader who doesn't really know what his own people are doing. And he claims to be this executive who's always making great decisions, et cetera. I don't know. It was a strange answer for him to claim he didn't really know. But the point is that language did change in the party platform. Then he talks about Crimea, and he's saying, well, first of all, he said, Randy, well, Putin's not in Ukraine. He seemed not to know at that moment that that's not true.
It was a very puzzling series of answers that he gave. So Clearly, he should know that Russian forces are in the portion of Ukraine which Russia has annexed, right, which is Crimea. Perhaps he wasn't including that in his definition of Ukraine, but it's official U.S. policy that that's part of Ukraine.
Yeah.
He may or may not know about the proxy war that's going on in eastern Ukraine. It would be remarkable if he didn't know about that. Sort of I think the most charitable interpretation of that is that he chooses to believe the Russian sort of propaganda view that it's not Russian forces that are in eastern Ukraine, that that's actually a homegrown indigenous guerrilla movement.
Which has been
but
largely proven
naive.
Not to be the case, right?
Right. I mean, it's been there's nobody who believes that either in the Obama administration or in Congress. I mean,
Republican or Democrat.
I mean, that's just an extraordinary position to take. Or perhaps he's just unaware of that conflict entirely, but that would be rather remarkable, I think. If you read the newspapers, you would think you would be aware of that.
And then on Crimea, he's saying, well, sure, it was annexed, but I've read the polls and, you know, a lot of people in Crimea are fine with that.
Well, I mean, he's not wrong about that. I mean, it's true that a majority of the people who live in Crimea were pleased to be annexed by Russia. And it was a longstanding thorn in the side of Ukraine that this section of the country wanted to secede for 20 years. And it was a mostly Russian ethnic and Russian, of course, Russian speaking enclave in the country. It's a separate question of whether it's okay to invade portions of other countries that might be willing to join your country and then hold a plebiscite and see whether they want to join your country. That's not consistent with international law, and it's a very dangerous precedent to set. And it could potentially lead to all kinds of invasions of all sorts of countries. And part of the reason we have a body of international law is to try to smooth away those conflicts and make that less likely.
Okay. Let me get to the phones. And I'm going to start with Gene in Rochester. Go ahead, Gene.
Yes, it seems to me kind of incredible that Clinton and the Democrats are accusing Putin of intervening in U.S. elections in favor of Donald Trump when the United States intervenes in elections all over the world, but especially in the Ukraine. The Orange Revolution had plenty of U.S. operatives there. You know, you're mentioning the operative from Donald Trump as favoring Yanukovych, but I'm sure the U.S. had plenty of their actors working against it, too. I mean, doesn't this seem like a kind of a hypocritical double standard? And haven't really, in my opinion, that whole thing in the Ukraine was basically a right-wing coup which overthrew Yanukovych.
All right, go ahead, Randy Stone. Thank you, Gene.
Well, that sounds like you've been reading Russian media, and so I'd be curious to talk about, you know, what the sources of your information are and so forth, and I think it's hard to get too much of that perspective without reading Russian. So I suspect you may have that ability, and that would be an interesting conversation. But there is a propaganda view of the Ukraine conflict, which has been put forward very strongly by Russian television and media, directed by the Russian state. And we have to just be clear that we are back in the era when you can't trust Russian media to be even pluralistic, much less unbiased, that they're really marching lockstep in this respect. And so when you use the word operative, it suggests that you're talking about not just independent political consultants doing what they do, but you're talking about intelligence operatives or something who are following U.S. foreign policy. And it's simply not true that the U.S. intelligence community played any appreciable role in the events leading up to the Orange Revolution. That was a homegrown political protest. They knew that the election had been stolen. It was very clear. Everybody knew that. And it was a spontaneous street protest that then went on for weeks and weeks. The same charge has been made about the 2014 protests, that somehow this was whipped up by the CIA, that we have this incredible ability to just create street protests wherever we want to and destabilize pro-Russian governments and create democratic transitions. And if that were the case, there wouldn't be dictatorships all across the former Soviet Union. The United States doesn't have those kinds of capabilities. Never has.
All right, let me grab our next call. And this is a longtime supporter of Donald Trump, Assemblyman Bill Nojay on the line. Go ahead, Bill. Thanks for taking the time to call.
Well, thank you for allowing me. I just, as somebody that was there in 2004 during the Orange Revolution, I witnessed the U.S. government very strongly supporting the democracy movement and Yushchenko's efforts. In fact, it was widely known that it was the United States government that probably kept Yushchenko alive after he was poisoned. But it, when I went back in 2010, during the Obama administration, I didn't see, and my colleagues, we saw almost no support for the more pro-Western, pro-democracy movement, which is how Yushchenko won. I'm sorry, how Yanukovych won. So we keep talking in this show about Donald Trump, Donald Trump, Donald Trump. It was under Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton that Yanukovych came into power. And it was under Barack Obama that Putin invaded Crimea and effectively invaded the eastern provinces. So I don't understand that we seem to be in this show talking an awful lot about how Donald Trump is siding with Mr. Putin. In fact, it's been Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton that allowed Yanukovych to come into power and then for Putin to conquer these parts of Ukraine. So I just let's give credit where credit's due here. If anybody is responsible for Putin's increased influence in Ukraine, it's Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, since it's happened on their watch, not Mr. Trump's.
All right, Assemblyman Nojay, stay there. Go ahead, Randy Stone.
That's a really interesting comment. I mean, I think it suggests that you think that the United States has an awful lot of control over these far-flung parts of the world. I mean, our power and influence can be very substantial in some cases, but it's very, very difficult to guide the domestic politics of other countries. We're very limited in what we can accomplish. I mean, if you want to dissect the sort of the origins of Yanukovych's incredible comeback story, where he went from being the failed dictator who was almost universally hated in 2004 to then being reelected with a plurality of the vote in the parliamentary system and becoming prime minister, to then winning a national election, narrowly, but winning a national election in 2010. It's a complicated story. It was highly unlikely to happen, I think. I would say that the biggest contributor to that was the really incompetent behavior of the opposition in Ukraine. Viktor Yushchenko, who was the president, and Yulia Tymoshenko, who was the prime minister, could not get along with each other. They were leading opposing factions. They fought. They did not run the economy very well. They had a series of IMF programs that were not implemented, and they didn't carry out the economic reforms. It just one thing after another was done badly. And so it was really easy for Yanukovych to come along and say, look, this is you elected these folks. They're a bunch of clowns. They can't run the country. They're running it into the ground. Maybe I'll be better. And So with his sort of simple diagnosis of the problem, the economy's bad, the lack of really a credible sort of liberal alternative, and then playing the national card.
But why, Randy, why not have Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, essentially, this would be fascinating, go up against Paul Manafort in that campaign? Because, of course, Paul Manafort, who's Trump's guy now, was the one helping Viktor Yanukovych on his way back to power. But why not have Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama trying to create more of an active role here. Mm-hmm. You're saying it's unrealistic to expect us to be able to move the levers of power that much?
I think that when we try, it tends to backfire. It's sometimes it can be effective to what's most effective is providing things like democracy assistance, try to create institutions that work better. And the United States has provided a lot of aid to Ukraine for democracy assistance. We can also try to help on concrete things like promoting certain kinds of common sense economic reforms, which they have an awful hard time doing in Ukraine. And if they'd done if they'd implemented those better, then the outcomes would have looked better and their politicians would have been more popular and so forth. But if you seem to be doing what Putin seems to be doing, trying to put your thumb on the scales of the election, that provokes a backlash. And you want to be very careful not to do that.
Right? Bill Nogue, if Barack Obama had said he's not sure we would honor our NATO commitments to allies unless they have paid their dues, what would you have said about Barack Obama?
Well, the historical record is that Barack Obama stood by and looked the other way while Putin invaded Crimea.
So should we have gone to war there, Bill?
The Eastern provinces.
Should we have gone to war there?
I'm not suggesting that we should have. I'm saying that most of this conversation in the last hour has been focused on whether Donald
That's not
Trump
a NATO member, Bill.
That.
That's not a NATO and, member. We're talking about NATO members, and we're talking about a possible president saying, I won't honor a commitment.
In 2004, when Putin tried to influence the elections and backing Yanukovych, the United States was, I believe, absolutely a critical and essential part of the victory of democracy and the election of Yushchenko. And the fact that we effectively withdrew from involvement with that part of the world under Obama and Hillary Clinton, that's why we're even talking about Yanukovych again.
Okay. I take your point. I mean, I think you and Randy will probably disagree on some of the fundamentals there. But let me also ask you, are you bothered by the fact that it was Paul Manafort who helped revive Yanukovych's career, who backed what is very clearly the wrong guy? He backed Ferdinand Marcos. All of this history, does that bother you, Bill?
I don't know exactly what Manafort did, so I don't really have an opinion about it. I
Do
know
you
that
want
was
to
a,
find out?
He was hired to give election advice.
I mean, I've got articles.
Also remember that at that time that he was there, in fact, Yushchenko was a failed leader. As we just discussed.
Yes, everybody agrees. He was a disappointment to the Orange Revolution. It doesn't mean Yanukovych was the right horse to ride back to power. But Paul Manafort told the West we just misunderstood him. And you're telling me, I don't know about that. You know, you seem anti-curious about Paul Manafort's history.
No, I'm not anti-curious. I'm just saying I don't know what he did there. And that's not being curious.
He got the guy back into office.
At the time, there was disarray because you had the different oligarchs supporting different political candidates. And by 2010, and I was there in 2010 in the western part of the country, it was a mess. But the United States by that time, this is my point, the United States, the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton had effectively withdrawn the United States from the kind of meaningful involvement that we had back in 2004. And that, to the extent that you can say, look, at Yanukovych was reelected, that was an unfortunate thing. I wouldn't blame it on Paul Manafort. I would blame it on the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton. I mean, compared to Paul Manafort's one guy with some support staff. The United States government effectively withdrew from meaningful involvement in that election cycle. And so if there's anybody you want to blame for Yanukovych's return to power, rather than blaming some political consultant, take a look at the White House and the Secretary of State, who now wants to be president.
All right, Bill, I have to let you go because we're down to 90 seconds, but I hope that Assemblyman Nogue will come on this program again because I know he's been a Trump supporter, and I mean that. I want to talk to him more about these issues and many other issues. We've been talking about Trump and Putin and Russia and Ukraine for most of the hour with Randy Stone from the University of Rochester, but I don't think you can disavow Paul Manafort's influence there and just say, well, it wasn't his fault when the people around Yanukovych were saying, thank you, Paul, for all the work that you did there. And I would say, Bill, if you don't know the history of Paul Manafort, Ferdinand Marcos, and others, I would definitely get down with it. I can send you some articles if you want. Absolutely. I'd be happy to do that. And we're down to about 40 seconds, Randy, but he mentioned a number of things. I'm curious to know, if we could open up Donald Trump's tax returns, which he has not released, what would you hope to find? 30 seconds. What would you be curious about to see in a tax return?
That's right. I'm not rooting for anyone to hack into his tax returns and make them
Russia
public
or
anything like that.
Yeah.
But I guess what I would be most concerned about. Is there serious evidence there of financial dependence on Russian oligarchs? Because there have been some serious allegations raised about that in the New York Times. And that if he is, in fact, financially dependent and perhaps as a result has a conflict of interest with American foreign policy, that would be very worrisome.
But it sounds like Manafort and Trump have said we should not be expecting his tax returns anytime soon. Randy Stone, thank you for the hour, which has vanished all too quickly. But I appreciate your background. And again, I'll state it again, just in case anybody was confused about it. I invited Dr. Stone, who's the director of the Skolnick Center for Polish and Central American Central European Studies at the University of Rochester, because he has been, I think, a very sort of a fair, apolitical person, whether it's talking about Obama, Clinton, Trump, or otherwise over the years. And we appreciate you being here. Thank you.
Thank you much.
Short break. Monthly Science Roundtable's next.